You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. And we're streamed on the Internet at KHEN.org. And if you would like to listen to tonight's programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.gimmesometruth.info or links in the KHEN.org website. And I'm Melody, and my co-host tonight is Professor of Geography, Dr. Eric Carlstrom at California State University Stanislaus, with nearly 30 years of teaching experience, and his academic research is focused on using soils and landforms as a means of reconstructing climates and environmental conditions of the past. And our special guest tonight is Jim Fetzer, and we're having him back. We've had him here several times in the past, and he's a wealth of information. And I will let Eric introduce him, and Jim can also tell us a little bit about his things that he's been up to lately. Eric?
Okay, well, yes, we have had Dr. James Fetzer in interviews before and found him to be a great wealth of information. He founded Scholars for 911 Truth. I think it was back in 2005 or so, wasn't it, Jim?
Yeah, and December 2005, yeah.
Yeah, and he presided over what I think is probably the best of the 911 conferences. There have been many national and international conferences in 2007 in the summer. He sponsored a conference in Madison, Wisconsin called The Science and Politics of 911, What's Controversial and What's Not. The many lectures, excellent lectures of that conference are available on a DVD, I believe, off of Dr. Fetzer's website. Dr. Fetzer is an emeritus professor. His subject is the philosophy of science. He is associated with the University of Minnesota, and I think I'll turn it over to you, Jim, if you want to expand upon that introduction, and then if you could bounce it back to me, I'll ask you how things are going with the 911 Scholars.
Sure, that's great, Eric. I appreciate it all. Anyone who wants to know more about me, it's real simple. Just put in your Google search, Jim Fetzer, and it'll give you Scholars for 911 Truth home page. It'll give you Assassination Science. It'll give you my Wikipedia entry. It'll give you The Real Deal, which is a radio show I host, and a whole lot of other stuff, where I might mention in particular that I have a blog that presents or archives some of my most important work on 9/11, JFK, Wellstone, and other subjects, which can be found at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com.
Well, go ahead.
Let me go ahead
and say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and are my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. Okay, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I'll just set the stage a little bit. The last 911 conference I was attending, Jim, was in Chandler, Arizona, and it was at that conference that I heard you speak, as well as Dr. Stephen Jones, who was the first professional physicist to get on board the 911 Truth movement and try to understand what actually happened on that day. And I remember that at that point there was a schism that had developed in the 911 Scholars between you and Dr. Jones. You had founded it, the 911 Scholars together, but at that point you went parted ways. And I remember you recommending that we look into the work of Dr. Judy Wood, who had come up with an alternative theory for what brought down the World Trade Center, namely directed energy weapons. That was in January 2007. Here we are. It's April 2010. Could you briefly bring us up to date on what has happened with the movement, with the 911 Scholars, and with this schism that seems to have kind of divided the people who are researching the issues surrounding 911?
Sure. When I founded Scholars in December 2005, I invited Steve Jones to be my co-chair Steve has been very keen on a certain hypothesis about how the Twin Towers were destroyed involving an incendiary called thermite, or in a more sophisticated version, thermate, or in a yet even more technologically advanced form, something called super thermite. But by June of 2006, at the time of the American Scholars Conference organized by Alex Jones in Los Angeles, I was already entertaining grave doubts about whether the thermite business could be sufficient to convert two 500,000-ton buildings into very fine dust. And that remains my position to this day. By the end of the year, I'd become quite interested in the work of Dr. Judy Wood, a former professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson University. And it was after I had her as my featured guest on a radio show. As I recall, the date was around 11 November. I was in Tucson, as I recall, and I'd had the interview with her on Saturday, and then Sunday and Monday I gave lectures and I began talking about her work. This brought about the schism between me and Steve. I wanted to broaden the range of hypotheses to consider in order to explain what had happened to the Twin Towers, because there's such a massive damage that was done to the other buildings. It wasn't just that you had these 210-story buildings that were converted to dust from the top down, so that they were actually destroyed below ground level, but there was a lot of very strange additional damage to Building 6, which had a huge gouged out missing center, Building 5, which had all these cookie cutter like cutouts in it, Building 4, half of which was missing completely, half of which was standing, Building 3, a Marriott Hotel, looked as though an enormous Paul Bunyan had hit it with a gigantic axe. So there are all these other strange aspects to it, including, of course, the so-called toasted cars. We had 100, 150 vehicles or more, some at considerable distance from the building, that had weird effects. They might have the front engine, the engine block might be melted, and the rear of the car might look like it was brand new. So Judy Wood had done a brilliant job of compiling a photographic record of all this kind of damage that you can find on her website, which is drjudywood.com. And it made a great impact on me. This is technically known as, you know, these are the effects that we're trying to explain. In philosophy of science, it's known as the explanandum. So that if you were to visit my Wikipedia entry, you'd see at one point it talks about explaining the explanandum, where it reports accurately that I have become convinced that Judy has done a better job not only of accounting for what it is we have to explain, but also in developing her hypothesis, the concept of her hypothesis. One of the problems I have with Steve's work is I have never really been introduced to an explanation of what would have happened had this use of thermite been involved here. It seems to me that it's in a hypothesis in search of a form of vindication. And in the meanwhile, in the course of my radio show, which is called The Real Deal, and where you can find the archives on radiofetzer.blogspot.com, I have been, you know, interviewing students who have different views about this. One particularly interesting fellow going by the name of Curtis, whom I've had on the show now for 5 hours, and who has introduced me to Tesla technology, where he's offering the proposal that high frequency vibrations could bring about the molecular dissociation of steel as well as concrete. And this is really quite fascinating. If you go to the blog, the jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, and track down new 9/11 photos released, you will see where I time sequence some photos that actually were old photos but being re-released for some, to my mind, not yet obvious psychological reason. Maybe it was to, you know, bring back the horror of the whole event to the American people for the sake of manipulating us for some then pressing political agenda. But when you time sequence it, you can see the buildings are being converted to very fine dust. And what Curtis pointed out is that there isn't a lot of dark smoke. You'd expect if explosives and thermite had been responsible that there'd be a lot of black, dark black smoke. And if you study the gross effects, which the official account, of course, cannot begin to accommodate. I mean, the idea that this was some kind of collapse brought about by the impact of planes and fires causing steel to weaken or melt is so preposterous, even on its face, that I can't believe anyone who has ever taken a serious look at the evidence could continue to entertain it. So that if anyone out there has any doubts about the lack of validity of the official account, just go to my blog and track down the new 9/11 photos released and take a look at what you see there. And you'll recognize the monstrousness of the lies we have been fed. Now, this has caused me to entertain a broad range of hypotheses that go beyond thermite, thermate, or even super thermite, plus some kinds of conventional explosives, to consider the possibility of mini nukes, third or fourth generation, some of which are extremely sophisticated, or possibly some form of Tesla technology, or possibly some kind of directed energy weapon, where I suppose the Tesla technology could be regarded as one or another version of a kind of directed energy weapon. And I have taken, you know, Curtis has sent me some very interesting diagrams and so forth, so I've created a blog about Curtis's views that you can also find there. I must say that in relation to the thermite hypothesis, when Jesse Ventura on his conspiracy theory show focused on 9/11, he had a single steel beam there that was being subjected to a thermite process. And as I observed to my wife at the time, I said, it's taking more time for the thermite to cut through the single beam than it did for the buildings to be destroyed, which was, of course, in about 10 seconds, which seemed to me that this was, an illustration that actually undermined the thermite hypothesis rather than supporting it. Plus, of course, to have a single isolated beam, Eric, is very unlike these two massive 500,000-ton steel reinforced buildings, because that interlocking lattice of the steel from the external support columns through the trusses to the core columns meant that it was an enormous heat sink. So that if you try to heat up one part of one of these beams, which won't melt until you get to around 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, you'd have to heat up a huge section of the building. Otherwise, it's all just drawn off by the other parts, steel connected parts of the building. So there have always been these major problems. And so far as I can see, Stephen Jones, although he's wildly enthusiastically received on many fronts, and although we have Richard Gage, who's the head of the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, traveling all over the country extolling the virtues of thermite as the explanation for the destruction, frankly, I don't see it. I don't believe they have an adequate hypothesis, and I've been very troubled that, in essence, that Gage is marketing a bill of goods.
Yeah, well, if I could add a couple things. We did have an opportunity finally to interview Dr. Judy Wood, Melody and I, and I actually have written up summaries of the interviews that I've done with her and with yourself and with various other 911 researchers, and those are posted not only on Melody's website where her archived interviews are, but also on a website that I've put together called www.911nwo.com, and so I feature Dr. Judy Wood's work quite a bit. Yeah, certainly it gets into Tesla technology, and Judy Wood's PhD is in interferometry, so she understands how wavelengths of radiant energy work and how they can be used. Tesla apparently invented a thing called the death ray, what it was commonly known as the death ray, over 100 years ago, and it said, that he could destroy airplane engines 250 miles away. He could just kind of melt them down. He said he could split the Earth in two with resonant frequencies, setting up standing waves. All you have to do is interfere wavelengths, different wavelengths at particular frequencies. He understood radiant energy, and of course he invented alternating current. So I think Tesla technology, directed energy weapons, very much the same thing, probably the best explanation. Anybody who looks at the Twin Towers coming down can see that the buildings are being turned to dust as from the top down. And there is a magazine, apparently. Now, of course, the U.S. military and its contractors are very much into this kind of energy weapon, directed energy weapon. Israel has been doing lots of contracting on this sort of thing. And there are many professional groups that talk about this, and I understand their journal is called Wavefront. What's surprising to me, Jim, and I'll mention one more thing before we get back to the directed energy weapons. What's surprising to me is that we haven't had more physicists who have an understanding of directed energy weapons. I know this is classified military stuff, but this stuff has been known for 100 years. It has been perfected in the Soviet Union during the Cold War, and now can be used for weather modification and all kinds of things. But speaking of the Russians, there's a Russian intelligence officer named Dmitry Kalazov, who now is saying that he knows that many nukes were used in the destruction of the Twin Towers. It seems to me that there could have been more than one technique used. There could have been pre-planted explosives, which I suppose could have involved what Stephen Jones and his followers are calling now nanothermite. But it seems to me that directed energies are a very big part of the story, and of course this is very exciting and scary and controversial, because directed energy weapons, if they're out there, means that there are weapons out there stronger than nuclear weapons, more powerful, more dangerous, and that's the bad news. And the good news is free energy, a la Nikola Tesla, may also be out there and available. And of course, I think maybe the power elite would just assume that the average person in the world not have access to free energy, because that would remove all class distinctions quickly. So it's a rather exciting prospect to try to actually understand what actually happened on that particular day. Now we've had suggestions of weather modification since 9/11, and we know more weather modification has occurred before, which also may be using Tesla technology.
HARP or whatever variation of this. Yes.
Yeah.
And I take it, Eric. Your URL of 911nwo.com means 9/11 New World Order.
Yes.
I mean, if there is the possibility of free energy, of course, the last thing that the people are ever going to learn is that it exists, because it'll be bottled up and controlled by the powerful corporations whose massive profit margins would be affected by the existence of this free energy. So it's a massive political problem. I mean, the morality of free energy is obvious, but the politics are hugely complicated, and it's we have such a convoluted arrangement in terms of the power distribution, wealth, and influence today in the United States, that it's very difficult to see how, even if we had available free energy, that it's ever going to make its way to the people, at least within, you know, our lifetimes, or those perhaps of our children.
Yeah. And this is, of course, is a whole another story. But I think when we start to open up this Pandora's box of Tesla technology, the story is that Tesla himself died suddenly, I think in 1942, on the night before he was supposed to meet with FDR, and that his papers were seized by the military and classified.
Curtis has been introducing me to Tesla technology, has explained that it appears that Tesla was in fact murdered, and in the 5 hours of conversation we've had, he has had some, you know, a lot of extremely interesting stuff about Tesla's science, and some extremely bizarre stuff about Tesla politics, or the way in which Tesla was managed and murdered by his account, that I think many would find a fascination. Again, that's at the at the Real Deals archive, radiofetzer.blogspot.com, or you can go to my blog, and you can find the page that's dedicated to what Curtis has to say about Tesla technology, which I am rather confident has links to my interviews with him. So if you go to jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, you can find that too. Now, Judy,
go ahead. Well, I was just going to say that, you know, you've been in academics. I think you're now retired, full professor. I am also an academic. I'm a full professor, still in harness, I guess you could say. And I recall well that during the 80s, there was an enormous amount of federal dollars being spent by the National Science Foundation for this thing called Star Wars, or Strategic Missile Defense,
sure,
which Ronald Reagan promoted because he had this kind of simplistic notion that we could intercept missiles from the Soviet Union and therefore live in a world of safety. Well, I think the Star Wars thing, which everybody and his brother who could possibly figure out a way to get in on that bandwagon and that gravy train, all of a sudden tried to get some of that federal money. Well, in the 90s, of course, it's been global warming. But in the 80s, it was all Star Wars. So we had a tremendous amount of research, which was really, I think, related to the Tesla technology. So I think that our knowledge of Tesla directed energy type of systems is very extensive in the military. But this is off the books. This is unofficial, like the HAARP, the High Active Frequency Aurora Research Program in Alaska. There's a lot of kind of waffling on the part of the Air Force and other military agencies that actually fund it as to what it's for. But in fact, there has been an enormous amount of military research. And again, this is not, a lot of this is classified. So what I'm suggesting is that there are companies and individuals in the military who are very expert at this. Our technologies are way beyond what the common person could fathom or comprehend. And I think that on 911, at least Dr. Judy Wood thinks that on 911, the world saw what this kind of technology is capable of. I asked Dr. Judy Wood if she thought that intelligence agencies of other countries would have recognized what was being demonstrated, and she said, "Oh yes." So it could be that we, the people, are really kind of left out. We're not in the know, whereas there is a kind of a scientific military contingent, perhaps across the world in many countries, that are at a level that we're still trying to guess at.
Well, I'll just say, you know, comment about two or three aspects of what you're mentioning here. There's a lot of indication that was Israeli involvement in the events of 9/11. There's a new website devoted to this called rediscover911.com. I just featured a book that I read, 9 chapters or so on my last show on Monday, entitled Stranger Than Fiction, An Independent Investigation of the True Culprits Behind 9/11 by Albert D. Pastore, PhD. That turns out to be a pseudonym. But what astonished me, Eric, is that this book is so sophisticated, given that it was published in 2003. And when you begin to sort out the massive influence that the Israeli government exercises on American foreign policy, when you start to put all the pieces together, when you realize the multitude of false flag attacks that have Israeli or Mossad fingerprints all over them, many of which, by the way, I have discussed in blogs at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, which includes 2 attacks in Buenos Aires in 1992 and 1994. The events of 7/7 in London, of course, are really a textbook case of a government exercising a terrorist attack in exactly the same plan of an alleged drill, where Maud Dibb, this quite brilliant fellow who lives in Ireland, created. And if anyone wants to see something sensational, you know, go to my blog and find the 7/7 ripple effect and watch watch it, because in 1 hour you go from A to Z through how the government arranges to put these drills in place and then turns them live and then seeks to tidy up the loose ends. But where there was an attack, attempted attack on the Mexican Congress shortly after 9/11, where they caught red-handed two Israeli agents, one of whom apparently was a colonel in the Mossad, and they had RDX, they had a powerful weapon, they had a lot of money. I mean, it was stunning. Where the purpose appears to have been to convince Mexico that it ought to join into the war on terror and provide the United States with unlimited cheap oil, so that the United States would no longer be dependent on the Saudi Arabia and other Arab nations, where the whole motivation from a political point of view for 9/11 was to create a profound antagonism between Americans and Arabs, or between Christianity and Islam, and it was all facilitated compliments of Israel, which had the most to gain and which appears to have made many contributions. I mean, it's really stunning when you look at all the evidence, Eric, and yet this is a virtually taboo topic in the American mainstream media. I published a couple articles about it, including one that was based on a talk I gave on the grass in front of the Capitol on April 15th, 2005 at a Ron Paul Freedom Rally, which subsequently was published under the heading 9/11 and the Neocon Agenda. And if you Google that, you'll find several different versions, meaning it's the same words in the same order, but some have illustrations and active links, others have active links, and one version just it doesn't have either illustrations or active links. And then there's yet a subsequent article I published entitled, Is 9/11 Research Anti-Semitic? And if you Google that, you'll find a version that does have the active links for all the key pieces. So that I highly recommend that. Anyone who thinks that Israel is just sitting by the sidelines while the rest of the world goes on its own course and charts its own history simply doesn't understand the way in which particularly Zionists, those who have been convinced that Israel is entitled to its homeland in Palestine, that want a greater Israel, essentially they want to get rid of all the Palestinians, that, and also combine that with a belief in Israeli superiority. I mean, listen, this is something I was even completely oblivious to up until a couple of years ago, when I realized I needed to get a handle on Zionism and figure out what it was all about. And I started featuring experts in the area, such as Stephen Lendman and Chamish, is it Barry Chamish, and eventually Elias Davidson, who was even born in Palestine but is of Jewish background. I mean, this was utterly fascinating stuff. And all these interviews can be found on radiofetzer.blogspot.com. I mean, it's very controversial, because the power of the Anti-Defamation League and the American-Israeli PAC and all that is so immense that practically no politician is able to stand up to them, and the few that do seem to suffer a series of unexpected misfortunes almost immediately. A prominent example being when Bill Clinton managed to bring Yasser Arafat and Rabin to, you know, accommodate a peace agreement that was on the verge of resolution. Not only does Rabin get assassinated by a Zionist zealot who actually walks in between the security team that's supposed to be protecting him and shoots him some five times, but Bill Clinton, who wants to persevere anyway, winds up with a stunning Monica Lewinsky scandal, and it all appears to have been, you know, to preclude the possibility of bringing out about a peace agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians, where I just say, you've got to look at the evidence here to believe what I'm saying, and I don't ask anyone to take my word for it, but I do say there's a huge issue here. Because if the American people don't wake up to the realization that our foreign policy is being dominated by the interests of another nation that doesn't really care about the lives of Americans, then, you know, we're really missing the big picture with regard to the fate of our own nation.
Well, I certainly appreciate your honesty and your directness and your courage, because This is a conclusion that I've come to myself, as well as, of course, I'm reading this in lots and lots of articles. There's an Italian president of the Italian Senate who said the CIA and Mossad carried out, Mossad being the Israeli intelligence agency, carried out 911 with the help of the Zionist world. Alan Zabrowski, who was a 10-year Marine and former U.S. Army War College guy, pins the 911 operation on Mossad, again, the intelligence agency of Israelis. There are a number of articles that say that the cover-up, the 911 cover-up, both in the U.K. and the United States, has been overseen by Zionists. There is another article which talks about 103 co-conspirators who are suspected of complicity or orchestrating covering up 911, and many, yes, many of these individuals were in the Bush administrations. They were neocons, and they were, many of them have dual American Israeli citizenship.
Can I?
And just a second. Okay. And only there is only one country in the world that where it is possible to have American dual citizenship with America, and that is Israel. So, and some of the things that you're saying about the Mexican operation, et cetera, were it featured in a movie called Missing Links, which I suppose you've probably seen, Jim. But there's just a wealth of information that traces this back, this operation back to the neocon agenda, as you wrote, the neoconservatives, amongst them Richard Perle, William Kristol, Irving Kristol, a whole series of Zionists.
Yeah,
with dual American Israeli citizenship.
Wolfowitz and Donald Fife and, you know, Paul Krauthammer and a whole host of others. Yes, there are about a dozen extraordinarily powerful figures, all of whom were Zionists, who were in key political positions when the second Bush administration began.
And, of course, the goal of all of this, of course, is to set up a false flag operation where Arabs are blamed for attacking the United States. This then allowed the United States to prosecute two wars in the Middle East, and these were primarily for the benefit, especially the war in Iraq was primarily for the benefit of Israel. It did. The war in Iraq has served no objectives of American foreign policy except to secure access to oil. But the real winners, the cui bono, who benefits, the real who benefits in all of the 911 and the war in Iraq is the Israelis and their goal of an Eretz Israel or Greater Israel. Now, if you look at the map, or excuse me, the flag of Israel, there's a blue stripe at the top and a blue stripe at the bottom and the Star of David in the middle. And I understand that the blue stripe at the top and bottom represent the Nile and the Tigris rivers. And the concept of Greater Israel or Eretz Israel goes right back to the founding of Israel, Theodore Herzl and Ben-Gurion and all these guys. And this is their goal, to take over that portion of the Middle East.
That's a pretty big chunk of real estate, Eric. That's a pretty big chunk of real estate.
Yeah, and of course what is so alarming and concerning right now is that Israel, there's a lot of speculation that the hawks, the neocon hawks, are now and have been for a couple, 3 years advocating an attack on Iran. And
yes,
there is speculation that Israel, which itself has 300 or 400 nuclear weapons, which is hardly ever discussed, might initiate that attack and throw us then into a possible World War III, because Russia and China could conceivably side with Iran. And Iran itself, with, 70 million people, is no pushover. So we could be looking at a very, very dangerous situation, and this is where we, you know, may be drifting. So
yes,
I think all the implications here are very serious.
I agree completely, 100%. Melanie?
Well, my only contention is here is that we're calling them Zionists, and what I would like to hear said more is that we've got a criminal group of men who may be utilizing numerous different faces to pull off their events, and yes, they definitely have a Jewish origin or Zionist origin or whatever, but I think we have a tendency to forget that there's a bunch of other criminals involved with them.
Well, the Zionism seems to be the key that links together the powerful forces in finance, in the media and communication, in the government, and controlling foreign and military policy. So that what's crucial is to distinguish between Zionism, which is really a political ideology, and Judaism, which, of course, is a religion, because these are completely separable entities. As I have often pointed out, when 9/11 researchers have been attacked as being anti-Semitic, and when they've offered, for example, the parallel with Holocaust denial, that nothing could be less apt, because the Holocaust deniers were denying that their government had committed the atrocity of killing or murdering some 6 million Jews, whereas 9/11 truthers are affirming that their government is responsible for the death of some 3,000 other citizens. So the Holocaust comparison is completely ridiculous and opposite what they're trying to say. But it raises the specter of anti-Semitism, which of course is the real motivating political propaganda idea behind it all, where I point out that criticism of the government of Israel or the policies of the government of Israel or the actions of the government of Israel is completely separate from Judaism and entails no form of anti-Semitism. So that, you know, we have to clearly distinguish between them. Plus, of course, it turns out the term Semite is really a linguistic distinction, and virtually all of the Arabic languages are Semitic languages, so virtually all the Arabic people are actually Semites. So, you know, Israel has just propagandistically capitalized on the use of this term anti-Semite, taking it out of its historical context to use it as a political club. Now, the Iranians, who are, of course, Persian in their origin, are not Semites. But the idea of attacking Iran is such a monstrous catastrophe in the making that it fills me with dread every time I hear Netanyahu or some other right-wing zealot in Israel rattling the saber, or some American politician like John McCain or Joe Lieberman endorsing the idea. Because the estimates have it that an attack on the Iranian nuclear facilities would bring about immediately 1 million deaths. And that in the aftermath, the effects of the pollution from all of the nuclear fallout and so forth spreading over Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India would bring about an additional 35 million premature deaths due to cancer, leukemia, and similar maladies that would thereby be induced. So that if this were to happen, and God forbid it should be with American complicity, it will be one of the greatest war crimes in history. And the very idea that the United States should be considering any such action, it just appalls me. It disgusts me. It is so foreign to our traditions, our past, and our purported values. You know, Eric, if this comes to pass, it will be a travesty.
It could be the tinderbox that sets off a nuclear World War III. Let me just go through the names of a hundred. There's a great article, 103 people who are likely or suspected as 911 criminal co-conspirators. This was put out September 25th, 2007. Now listen to these names. Many of these, of course, are the famous neoconservatives who wrote the position paper called Project for a New American Century, which called for 100 years of American military might and a radical increase in the military budget, which they suggested probably wouldn't be approved by the American people absent some Pearl Harbor-like event. Well, of course, they got their Pearl Harbor-like event with 9/11. Here are the individuals, in addition to George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld: Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Secretary of War on 9/11, dual citizen of U.S. and Israel, Zionist, investigated for spying for Israel, former PNAC member, chief architect of Iraq War, forced to resign in World Bank scandal; Richard Pearl, former Assistant Secretary of War, Chairman, War Policy Board, and PNAC member, dual citizen of U.S. and Israel, Zionist, allegedly gave $100,000 to head of Pakistan's ISI, the Inter-Services Intelligence, Mahmoud Ahmad, nicknamed Prince of Darkness. He's, of course, a very key individual here. Douglas Faith, effectively in command with Wolfowitz of the War Department on 911, Undersecretary of War for Policy, dual citizen of U.S. and Israel, Zionist, investigated for spying for Israel, former PNAC member, Dov Zakheim, Pentagon controller when trillions of dollars were reported missing on 9/10/01, dual citizen of U.S. and Israel, Zionist, Shul Rabbi, former Council on Foreign Relations member, former CEO of Flyby Remote Manufacturer, reputed 911 mastermind. George Tenet, director of the CIA on 911, was awarded the Medal of Freedom by Bush for his fine work on 911, reported to be a dual citizen of U.S. and Israel. Michael Chertoff, Assistant Attorney General on 911, freed over 100 Israeli spies in the U.S. after 911, promoted to head of Homeland Security, dual citizenship of U.S. and Israel, Zionist, likely Mossad agent. I could go on. Michael Mukoski.
Yeah. It's a good
many,
list.
Many, many others.
Yes.
To go right on down the list. Philip Zelikow, Ari Fleischer, who was spokesman for Bush on 911. Just goes on and on and on. And you can go online, people, and get this article. It's http://educateyourself.org, and then read it. I mean, this is out there.
And when I spoke at the Freedom Rally on the grass in front of the Capitol on the 15th of April 2008, I pointed out how many of these key officials had joint U.S.-Israeli citizenship, and observed that how can we know that their allegiance to the other country does not outweigh their allegiance to the United States? Called upon them to resign. Each and every one that had dual citizenship should resign from their positions within the government.
Oh, absolutely. What a conflict of interest, especially when it comes to invading Iraq and the policy objectives of the Iraq war. And then as we've mentioned, the much more serious, estimates are that the United States military and foreign policy has killed upwards of 1 to 2 million Iraqis. We are talking genocide. Let's not gloss over the situation in Iraq. It's awful. It's hellish. But an invasion of Iran would strand the U.S. troops who are now in Iraq and Afghanistan and make them very vulnerable to attack and cripple the United States and could lead to a nuclear conflict.
And, of course, here we're talking about political and ideological conflicts. But anyone who thinks conflicts of interest don't make a difference should be reading the paper about Goldman Sachs, which it turns out at the very same time it was bolstering the household mortgage market and giving it AAA ratings. It was actually itself placing heavy bets in terms of what are called shorts that the market was going to collapse. So at one and the same time, it was promoting a product that it was itself actively investing in the collapse of, which is, you know, a grotesque form of conflict of interest, where the Republicans today in the Congress are refusing to allow the Senate to debate the issues about how to reform these financial entities. And I got to say, Eric, this is one of the most stunning displays of a lack of loyalty to the American people that I have ever witnessed in my life in public politics.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Goldman Sachs, because Goldman Sachs is, of course, the tip of the iceberg, but they profited mightily from the bailout. And of course, Henry Paulson himself was a former CEO of Goldman Sachs, as was Rubin under Clinton. It seems that the revolving door between government and industry is massive indeed. In fact, there is a journalist who did a story for the Rolling Stone who investigated all the connections between Goldman Sachs and the Treasury Department and other aspects of the U.S. government. And virtually the government is controlled by members, ex-members of Goldman Sachs and other major corporations who then wrote their own ticket for their own bailout. And not only that, but taking out their adversaries and destroying their competitors.
And Hank Paulson was a CEO of the Nature Conservancy, too. And that's
involved in the Nature Conservancy, yeah.
Yes, and that's the one that I'm waiting, that is lying in wait. That's the one.
Well,
where
and
I
also
think.
Also has been a partner with Al Gore in General Management Investments, one of the companies that would profit from a carbon tax and a cap and trade and an energy bill that would focus on global warming. So Goldman Sachs is heavily invested in this global warming scam, which is another scam and a hoax, I believe, Jim, and I think perpetuated perhaps by many of the same people. But since we are talking about Zionism, I think we are talking about many of the same kinds of individuals in the financial markets, that I think we could almost see this as a part of the overall strategy. Yeah. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. There's lots of overlap here. I mean, I think we can go all the way back to Mark Twain, who, as I recall, observed that we have the best government that money can buy. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, this global warming thing has troubled me for a long time, because I find it very difficult, based upon my studies of evolution and ecology, where two of my last three books dealt with evolution, that we could have an industrial revolution and be pumping all of this pollution into the environment and it not affect our ecosystem. I mean, it seems to me it has to be the case that there have been massive effects that have been brought about by industrialization, and that if we don't face up to it, we really truly are running the risk of extinguishing this little planet that we inhabit. So, you know, we may have some differences on that particular issue, but certainly we have none when it comes to the domination of American politics by Zionist forces and by corrupt institutions that are supposed to benefit the people, but in fact actually wind up serving their own interests best.
Let me just, I'm sure you probably saw on the internet the story of Bob Kerry, Senator Bob Kerry, I believe from Nebraska, who was on the 911 commission, who was interviewed by a reporter, I think in Los Angeles, on his way out of some meeting, and at that point Kerry admitted that 911 was a 30-year plan. Are you familiar with that interview?
No, but it doesn't surprise me at all, you know. I mean, that this should be the case. And, of course, Max Cleland, who was appointed to the commission, saw that how corrupt it was. You mentioned Philip Zelikow, you know, who it turns out has this fascinating history, because as an academician, his area of specialization, you're not going to believe this if you don't already know it, was the creation and perpetuation and maintenance of public myths, M-Y-T-H-S. Zelikow actually had a draft of the 9/11 Commission report prepared a year in advance before he even began sharing it with his staff, where the interviews and all that of witnesses was pure performance, mere theater, mere window dressing intended to create the veneer that would lend some credibility to the phony report they were then going to peddle to the American people.
Yeah, Zelikow, from what I understand, who, of course, is another dual American-Israeli citizen, another Zionist, actually wrote the 9/11 Commission report more or less by himself. There's virtually no references cited. It's a story. It's a story that has very little to do with the reality of 9/11 that you and I have studied so carefully.
Right, you're absolutely right, Eric. And when I founded Scholars, I mean, much of the purpose of bringing together a diverse assortment of very talented people, including, you know, engineers, physicists, structural, civil, pilots, and all that, was to test the adequacy of the official account. So if you think of the 9/11 Commission report as a theory suspended in space, then it's supposed to be linked to reality by these little threads that come down. Some of the threads have to do with the airplanes, others with the crashes, other with the destruction of the buildings and all that. And we have been systematically testing those threads, and none of them has been sustainable. In other words, every way in which the government has tried to link the 9/11 report to reality has come up short and has been falsified or repudiated. Just to offer one stunning illustration, Elias Davidson, an Icelandic scholar who now resides in Germany, undertook an analysis of the proof the government had to place the hijackers aboard the planes and discovered that they had never been able to prove that any of those hijackers were aboard any of those planes. Now, that's absolutely stunning. The one clip of video comes from a different airport at a different time. The stuff that is alleged to be so incriminating, you know, like Korans, which are found all over the place, and training manuals, are obvious frauds. I mean, planted evidence, you know, passports that survive the destruction of 500,000 ton buildings unscathed. It's absolutely stunning. They don't have any tickets or receipts. You know, the question is, how would they even have got aboard the plane? You know, they just show up the last minute and buy their tickets in cash. The whole thing is utterly preposterous. And if you just start examining these threads, you realize this whole thing is just an illusion that's floating in space, ungrounded to reality.
Are you gentlemen of the belief that 9/11 was a coup d'état? And if it was, was it a coup d'état by the Zionists, and that possibly with all these Zionist names that are involved with the Obama administration, I would think that that's a carryover.
Well, you see, you look at the Obama administration. What did I expect when Obama came into office? The guy had a background as a constitutional scholar, so I thought the first thing he'd do would put us on a firm constitutional basis. He'd rescind the Patriot Act, abolish the Military Commissions Act, close Guantanamo, abolish this extraordinary rendition, which is really kidnapping people abroad and then subjecting them to torture and all that. I thought that would all be done in the first 3 months. In fact, none of it has come to pass. He has not only not shut down the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, but he sent 30,000 more troops over there, and he's offered as his justification the attacks of 9/11, and even cited the name of Osama bin Laden, who, may he rest in peace, died around December 15, 2001. But the guy's such a handy boogeyman that even though the FBI itself announced, when confronted with a wanted poster for Osama that did not mention any events of 9/11, that it had no hard evidence that associated Osama bin Laden with the events of 9/11, the government glosses it over. And if this guy, Barack Hussein Obama, doesn't know any better than what he's saying about 9/11, then either he knows better, in which case he's competent but deceitful, or he doesn't know better, in which case he's incompetent and a dupe. And I'm just sorry to say that I'm forced to conclude that the situation we're in, precisely as you suggest, is a continuation of Bush administration policies. We even have the same head of the FBI, Robert Mueller, and the same Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, under Bush, which means that really, actually, the situation we're in is a continuation of the Bush administration in a what you might call Bush light, or alternatively, Bush in blackface.
Yeah, and let me just add, I think that's very, very correct. I certainly agree. And in this paper, 103 likely or suspected 911 criminal co-conspirators, number 9 is Robert Mueller, FBI director on 9/11. Under his leadership, FBI agents' warnings of an imminent attack were stifled. Let me just read a few more names here, if you don't mind, because you see a pattern. Lewis Scooter Libby, of course, he was the one indicted under Cheney. Former PNAC member, studied political science at Yale under Paul Wolfowitz, aide to Cheney, convicted for lying about outing of Valerie Plame, dual citizenship of the U.S. and Israel, Zionist Jack Abramoff, entertained USG terrorist Patsy Muhammad Atta on his yacht just before 911, convicted criminal lobbyist, ardent Zionist, Jeb Bush, who, of course, the president of our, the brother of our president, Rudolph Giuliani, mayor of New York, hailed as hero for his gutsy leadership on 911, allegedly involved with FEMA and former New York City police chief Carrick in Operation Code Angel. Louis Eisenberg, chairman, Port Authority of New York and New Jersey on 911, authorized transfer of World Trade Center leases to Larry Silverman, another Zionist, and Lowry, another, just weeks before 9/11, later appointed chairman of Republican National Committee, Zionist. John Deutsch, former Undersecretary of War, director of CIA, co-authored paper Catastrophic Terrorism and National Policy with Zelikow, and an affiliate of Rothschild North America, MIT professor, grandson of Yonah Fischer, Antwerp diamond merchant who ran Zionist Federation of Belgium. Michael Leiden, who's a famous guy, became anti-terrorism advisor to Secretary of State Al Haig in 1981. Contacts with mullahs in Iran-Contra affair, alleged ties to Italian fascist P2 Masonic Lodge. Contacts with Libby, Cheney's chief of staff, top neocon, advisor to Bush and Karl Rove, member of the American Enterprise Institute, wrote a book extolling fascism. So what I'm suggesting in my 911 New World Order website, Jim, is that, you know, we see the New World Order or the secret government show their fingerprints during a whole series of crimes, many of which you know better than I do, the assassination of JFK, the Iran-Contra, the October surprise, orchestration of wars like the Vietnam War, et cetera. And it is through these crimes, then, we can get to start to know what this secret government or this shadow government is about and what the goal is. Would you agree with that?
Yes, yes, I would. And, in fact, I'm very pleased to discover about your website because I think it would be a great one to establish links with rediscover911.com. You share many themes and reflect a more profound understanding of these events than the public is aware. And I just reiterate the brilliance of this book, Stranger Than Fiction, which I cannot get over, was published in 2003, because the massive support there for the perspective that you and I are both endorsing is simply overwhelming, and it traces the role of the Zionists in willing to sacrifice the lives of the citizens of other nations in World War I, in World War II, in what was known as the Levon Affair, the bombing of the King David by Israeli terrorists dressed as Arabs. They have honed this business of impersonating Arabs in order to perpetrate terrorist acts that are going to gain sympathy or political leverage for Israel to a high art, to a skill, even to a science. And everyone in the world has to understand this. I mean, the history here is absolutely stunning, and therefore I recommend this little book, Stranger Than Fiction. It's only, what, 150 pages, but by God, it is just jam-packed with valuable information, and it's very well written, and it's very well researched.
When you run down the names in the background of these this Zionist group, it still sounds to me like a Jewish mafia.
Oh, they sometimes call themselves, yeah, the Jewish mafia or the Zionist mafia. Yeah, it has that aspect. It's interesting you raise that question, because when I concluded my presentation on the grass in front of the Capitol on 15 April 2008, I said that we had a criminal enterprise that was masquerading as an administration in Washington at that time. And, of course, it has these Israeli tentacles are all over the Congress. I mean, it's absolutely stupefying if you get into the background of what's really going on, who's really calling the shots, and who's pushing the buttons and pulling the levers.
Right. I mean, because it would be like trying to say that the Italian mafia was the ones that were in charge of, which they may be in charge of Italy, I don't know, because I'm not up on the Italian politics. But again, they would not include all the Italian people into that. And yet, sometimes that's what seems to be inferred in the vice versa with Israel. Is that, am I stating that correctly?
You know, I think an awful lot of Israelis are naive about some of the actions of their own country. On the other hand, the Israelis, because of their precarious position as such a small nation surrounded by what they interpret to be hostile forces, have a greater degree, I think, of political awareness and sophistication than those perhaps of any other nation. Eric was mentioning that an attack on Iran could bring about a new world war, and I think that's entirely feasible. The Russians, after all, providing the engineers and the support for the nuclear energy facilities, which Iran is perfectly entitled under international law to develop for its own benefit. China is, of course, connected to Iran by contracts for obtaining oil from Iran. It has seemed to me for a very long period of time that there ought to be some kind of mutual defense pact between Russia and Iran and even possibly China, that once the Western world and Israel were aware of the existence of a defense pact between Iran and Russia, that all this talk about attacking Iran would cease and end forthwith.
Let me go ahead and say this is KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, and this is Truth Quest with Melody, and my co-host this evening is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and our special guest is Do you go by Professor Jim Fetzer or Doctor?
You can call me Dr. Jim or Fetz, okay, or whatever. I'll take them all now.
Okay. Jim Fetzer, anyway. So I'll go ahead and resume our discussion here on anywhere from 9/11 to many other aspects going on in the world. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you two gentlemen is the fact that, do you guys get a lot of questions about, well, 9/11's old hat, or I wasn't, you know, there's people out there that probably weren't even born when some of these false flag events took place. How do you answer some of that? Or do you get it?
Well, Barack Obama does a pretty good job of that for us all by himself when he talks about the reason he's sending 30,000 troops to Afghanistan is because that's the region from which we were attacked, which is, of course, false, and that we're in pursuit of Osama bin Laden, which is also false, particularly given that Osama has been dead for nearly a decade at this point in time. So, you know, if Obama is going to be espousing this political false information, if he's attempting to mislead the American people, you know, using distortions of history, if he doesn't understand any better, I'm telling you, we're in a serious bad way, because the guy who should be on top of everything seems to know nothing about the situations he's having to cope with.
Well, yeah, and I think this ignorance is almost universal in the press. I mean, what we hear on the news and read in the newspaper is that, you know, the enemy is Osama bin Laden, the enemy is the Taliban, and what's not understood is that the United States created the Taliban, the United States created and funded the Mujahideen during the 1980s as a way to kick the Russians out that had invaded during the 80s, so the United States employed Osama bin Laden and about 500,000 other criminal elements within the Muslim world. The United States intelligence agencies like the CIA created the madrasas, which are the schools for fundamentalist Islam, jihad, terrorism. We created the entire movement in the 80s.
Yes.
Now all of a sudden, you know, the Taliban have gone from being good guys to bad guys to good guys to bad guys, and no one seems to remember back one or two decades to the previous state of affairs. And it's almost as if they can get away with these blatant lies simply by repeating them. And I personally think that what's happening here is that there is an attempt to dumb down the American people with the repeated lies to such an extent that they can't they couldn't understand things if they wanted to.
Look how long it took us to reprogram ourselves from the programming that we got from Hollywood when they took over World War II. And the misconceptions in that one.
Yeah, let me just say what nice points you're making, that Al-Qaeda and even Osama were CIA creations. We gave those guys the Stinger missiles that enabled them to take out the Russian helicopters and planes of an event, a development so beautifully illustrated in the film Charlie Wilson's War, starring Tom Hanks and Julia Roberts, except they never mention Osama or Al-Qaeda as having a key role in this entire enterprise. They certainly emphasize the CIA's role in the providing of the missiles, but, you know, it's one of these things. I mean, Afghanistan has never been conquered by any foreign power, and you can go back to Alexander the Great. If Alexander the Great couldn't do it, if the Soviet Union couldn't do it, why in God's name would anyone think that the United States of America could do it? Nor why? You know, why should we be occupying this very bizarre chunk of real estate in this part of the country where we really don't belong any more than we belong in Iraq? I mean, we are armies of occupation. In Ronald Reagan's language, if you were to describe the presence of American forces there and the opposition to them, the resistance leaders in Iraq and in Afghanistan would be described as freedom fighters. And, you know, the Americans have this utter incapacity to see things from the other person's point of view. It's very naive. I agree with Melody that we are, you know, we have become incredibly dumb as a people. We've become incredibly dumb. And to me, you know, I spent my whole life, I spent 35 years teaching courses in logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning, trying to enable students to see through the hypocrisy, the chicanery, the falsehoods being generated by the mass media. And it would be, you know, years later, after a student got out of one of my courses, that they'd cross me in the hall and say, "Hey, Dr. Fetzer, you know, you're a smart guy. You had that right."
Yeah, well, you know, let's talk about Afghanistan a little bit more, because I do remember when Ronald Reagan, during the 80s, the great communicator, brought some members of the Mujahideen onto the stage with him and said that they were the moral equivalents of the founding fathers,
that's
and he called
right.
them freedom fighters. And of course, now we would call them terrorists because they're against us. But one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist. It depends
exactly.
on which side you're on. And,
right.
Of course, there's an enormous amount of, right now, the poppy opium trade in Afghanistan. This is where most of the opium for Western Europe and the world comes from. And the CIA has been presiding over those profits ever since they got involved in the area.
Right.
And so we're talking about probably the most valuable commodities in the world when we talk about, well, they call it In God We Trust, guns, oil, and drugs.
Yes.
So illicit drugs, oil, and armaments, them each is a $1 trillion a year industry worldwide. And so certainly there's a geopolitical purpose for our presence in Afghanistan, but there's also an economic purpose having to do with oil pipelines, having to do with drugs, having to do with containing the Soviet Union and China access to the Arabian Sea, etc.
Let me comment on the poppy field business. I have intermittently featured someone from the Lyndon LaRouche organization because he was talking about some issue that was current, and I appreciated having a different point of view. But I talk with Don Pfau, who's kind of a key coordinator for the putting people out on the radio programs and all that. And he was telling me, this is like 10 days ago, perhaps, that Lyndon LaRouche was going to make a major announcement calling for a massive strike on the oil fields. And I think I actually got this in an email. I wrote him back and I said, this was insane that if they attacked the poppy fields, what would happen would be the price of heroin and drugs would simply skyrocket. And that, you know, all the drug cartels would become more powerful. The solution to this problem is to legalize all of these drugs. You take the power away from the drug cartels. Mexico right now is a lawless nation dominated by these drug warlords who are slaughtering each other, and the ordinary people are helpless. The Mexican army isn't even strong enough to cope with it. There's a simple solution. You legalize these drugs. You regulate them. You market them. You tax them. You solve your financial problems overnight. You no longer have the huge expense of pursuing, you know, actions against these criminal enterprises, either in terms of investment for investigation or prosecution or incarceration. All that disappears. People are able to make their choices about whether they do or do not prefer to use drugs, just as they do with every other drug, like alcohol, for example, and tobacco, which they're perfectly entitled to use, even though nicotine is the most addicting substance known to man. Well, if we can regulate and govern the sale of cigarettes, by God, we can regulate and govern the sale of marijuana or of other forms of drug usage, where most of us know enough to know that with regard to hard drugs, you're selling your soul to the devil if you become addicted, because it's going to warp the rest of your life. But the idea of having, you know, this massive attack on the poppy fields just stunned me. Absolutely stunned me, Eric.
Yeah, and I think going back to the geopolitics of it, people who are familiar with reading the newspaper over the last 25, 30 years would recall that at various times the U.S. backed the Northern Alliance, at various times it created and backed the Taliban, and then it flip-flopped to the other side when the Taliban wouldn't play ball with us on the drugs issue. So the whole basis of empire, of course, is to divide and conquer and get ethnic groups to fight each other and then supply them with arms. And this is what the U.S. has been doing. And
sure,
of course, in Afghanistan. Yeah, we have warlords.
Sure, Eric, the CIA is the biggest drug-running operation in the world.
Exactly.
I mean, it's absolutely stunning. The CIA, just as the United States is the greatest terrorist nation in the world. I mean, Americans just don't understand. They ought to go back and review recent history, for example, from Chile to Nicaragua to El Salvador to Guatemala to Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, to Iraq, you know, Afghanistan, and then Iran. I mean, our history is just so blatant and so disgusting for overthrowing other nations. No matter how democratic their government, we've done it again and again and again. And to claim that we're doing it in the name of freedom and democracy is simply absurd.
Jim, was
go ahead, Melody.
Jim, was that on one of your interviews where someone had mentioned that NATO had taken over for the CIA on those drugs?
It might have been, Melody. The whole role of NATO today to me is a bit mysterious. You know, I grew up believing NATO was one of the great, you know, good organizations for the benefit of man. Just as I grew up believing that of the United Nations, I still believe it with regard to the United Nations, but with regard to NATO, I'm no longer so sure.
Well, let me just speculate that at least I've read and heard the speculation that the CIA always their first allegiance was to Wall Street and even more importantly, the City of London, which is the world's financial center. And of course, that's located in London. And that the CIA never really did work for the American people, but was pushing this agenda, which we could identify with the secret government. So that the secret government or the shadow government, which is behind many of these scandals, always was affiliated with the City of London, we heard Alfred Weber say that Israel basically takes its marching orders from the City of London. So it could be that we need to look a little bit further and deeper than pinning everything on Israel. It could be that Israel is in cooperation with these major international financial powers that are
if you continued your list, Eric, I think you'd find that an awful lot of those major financial powers actually are themselves also Zionists. So
yeah,
that in fact there's a continuity here.
That,
you know, from the Balfour Declaration to the bombing of the King David and all that, there has been absolute dedication to creating this state of Israel, regardless of the consequences for others. It's often crossed my mind. I published an article years and years ago when the Israelis were invading Palestine and slaughtering people right and left, that when Jews start acting like Nazis, we're in big trouble. Well, we've been in big trouble for quite a while now, and it's not simmering down, you know. In fact, I've often contemplated that the ideal solution to the Palestinian problem from the point of view of these Israeli power brokers would be to load all the Palestinians aboard a ship, float it out to sea, and sink it.
Well, wasn't NATO, UN, and the CIA created about the same time?
1947 for the CIA, the National Security Act. United Nations was formed, I think, right after World War II in 1944 or 1945 at a meeting in San Francisco. NATO, I think, comes along later, doesn't it, Jim?
I think you're right. I think it's more early 50s.
Yeah.
But we could easily check that. I mean, that's one of the beauties of Google is you can find all those things at the touch of your fingers. Let me verify about NATO.
Okay, and what about the Zionists being, when you're talking about the Balfour Agreement, then you're taking it back to certain British and other...
Yeah, the precipitation of World War One. In order to bring about a realignment and gain control of land, seizing it from the Ottoman Empire and creating it as a British possession where then it could be managed and maneuvered for the sake of, among other things, creating the country of Israel. Here it says 60 years of NATO. Let me see. It looks like 1949 may have been the year. Let me see if I can.
Yeah, 1950, something like that.
Yeah. Let's see.
I thought it was
50.
Is it that late then? Okay.
Well, I'm looking for something more specific in terms of the timeline. Here, okay, NATO's first Secretary General is April 1952, so it appears to have been right in the, you know, the first years of the 1950s.
Okay.
Yeah, so what we're talking about is the formation of a post-World War II world order. And
but
I think
it's actually 1949, since securing our future, 1949 to 2009, 60th anniversary, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, so it actually is founded in 1949. So Melanie's pretty close. Those were all events that were occurring in very close proximity.
And at the same time, the Bretton Woods meeting was happening in Bretton Woods, Massachusetts or something like that in 1944, which established the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and set the rules for the international economic trade issues. So I think we are dealing with, probably the City of London financial arrangements being made in many, many, many different organizations. This is what I would call the secret of the shadow government, which is more powerful than any government, including the United States. So although for years, Jim, I was, I've got long lists of all the crimes of the CIA, and you talked about the governments they've toppled and the wars they've started, and it's a very, very long list, and there's a couple books out on it that one's called Killing Hope, History of the CIA Interventions Around the World, and it's exhaustive and it's very depressing. But I've written, and this is written up on my website. But what I've learned subsequent to my writing it up is that the CIA never worked for the United States government. It always worked for the international money powers. So in toppling these governments, in having all these coups, such as in Chile and, Iran and Guatemala, et cetera, the goal was not to help the American people, and for the most part, the American people were ignorant of these activities. So it becomes then interesting because people like Noam Chomsky, who I lost my regard for after his attempt to kind of gloss over the facts on 9/11, he likes to kind of couch the whole thing in very, very anti-American terms. The Americans did this, the Americans did that, we're awful, we did this and that. But in fact, I think the CIA was not working for our interests, and I think that's what needs to be emphasized so that we don't become radically divorced from the vision of our founding fathers, which I think was a pretty good one.
The Bretton Woods meeting was in New Hampshire in the first 3 weeks of July 1944, bringing together 730 delegates from all 44 allied nations to create the International Monetary Fund and the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, which is now part of the World Bank Group, and that's extremely powerful. If you read John Perkins' Confessions of an Economic Hitman, he explains how these international financial entities are used to hook developing nations financially so that they have debt burdens they cannot tolerate, they cannot sustain, and then exploit their natural resources at the behest or benefit of American or transnational corporations, where eventually, if they won't cooperate, that we send in the Marines. You know, it's a terrible, terrible story. But once again, I think if any American wants to understand what goes on in the world, they got to read Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins.
I would agree, and that's a classic example of what I guess the CIA would call a limited hangout, because I've seen and I've got both interviews that John Perkins did with Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, and I've got his two books, but what he does is he talks about how all these deals were arranged between his corporation, which was an American corporation, and foreign governments like Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Panama, etc. But then at the end he says, well, 9/11 changed his life because he realized that if he didn't spill the beans now and try to make it right, that his daughter wouldn't have much of a future. But he also basically endorses the myth of Osama bin Laden and 19 Arab terrorists committing 9/11. Now, I don't know if he does that deliberately or whether he does that on purpose, But it's like so many things where he tells you a lot of good things, important things, and then he takes you off base with some pretty profound disinformation. And so this makes me question then what his motives are.
Are you still talking about Noam Chomsky, or is this the Barack?
No, I'm talking about John Perkins now.
Perkins. You know, you mentioned Noam Chomsky. I got to say, I've got a little video on YouTube, actually two of them, about Fetzer on Chomsky. And one of them is rather short. It's only about 8 minutes long. The other's a little longer, 10, I guess, 15 something, whatever. But I'm pointing out that Chomsky, while he's wonderful on all the intermediate issues, you know, government propaganda and all that kind of stuff, when it comes to the big deals like JFK or 9/11, he sells out the nation. He's dismissed JFK. He says, who cares? So far as he can see, you know, even if there was a conspiracy, who cares? Because it didn't involve any major policy issues. And I defy him to justify that. We not only had the withdrawal from Vietnam, the non-invasion of Cuba, signing an above-ground test ban treaty with the Soviet Union, dismantling the CIA, reforming the Fed, the crackdown on the mafia. I mean, there's an issue after issue after issue that JFK was on the right side and the powerful forces were on the wrong. And if you read James Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable, you realize the manifest absurdity of the Noam Chomsky position. And of course, on 9/11, he wants to feign that this was blowback, you know, because America had been brutal to other nations abroad when it was in fact an inside job. So I say, shame on you, Noam Chomsky, and all those who follow him, because they're being duped by a master con man.
I totally agree, and I think this is pointed out very well in a book by Canadian journalist Barry Zwicker. It's called Towers of Deception. Now, Barry Zwicker was a journalist who was on to the 9/11 issue very early on, and he's got this book in which he has a chapter called Noam Chomsky and the Shame of the American Left Gatekeepers, or something like that.
Yeah.
And he identifies Chomsky as being one of these left gatekeepers. A lot of people put him on a very high pedestal, and when Noam Chomsky early on wound up supporting the official myth, and saying it was blowback, like you say, from, you know, nefarious activities of the CIA or whatever, a lot of activists believed him and therefore did not jump into the 9/11 research arena. So somebody like that did have a major role to play in, I think, stalling the 9/11 research movement. Shame on him.
That's absolutely right. The longer you stall it, the more likely it is that people are going to be diverted by other more pressing matters, especially of a practical concern, such as if you have a devastating economic collapse based upon the housing market bubble blowing.
Right.
You know, you got, gentlemen, one of the things that I still find the most important, even though we do have a number of them out there we disagree with or we don't necessarily like their slant on it, one of the main things that I still feel is most important why is discussing this topic is that we know the history of these events repeating themselves. And my other thing to add to that is if we don't hold these people more than just firing them or whatever, holding them accountable for what they've done, they are moving in the direction to hold us accountable for what we haven't done.
Well, Melody, we're in the midst of a fascist state, I'm sorry to say. Mussolini defined fascism as the merger of big business with big corporations, where the leader is treated as the personification of the state, and any criticism of the leader is treated as unpatriotic or even treasonous. This is exactly what we had during the George W. Bush administration. Now, Barack, in part because he's black, it doesn't receive that kind of deference from the right. But when, you know, Bush was in power, by God, anyone who criticized that guy, you would have thought they were going to string him up with a rope. So, you know, we when you have collusion between big government and big business, who's to look out for the little guy? The answer is there's nobody left to look out for the little guy. And, of course, what's been going on is there's been so much outsourcing of all these great jobs because of cheaper labor available in Southeast Asia, in China, and in India, that the companies are maximizing their short-term profits, but with the long-term risks that are enormous. Because once you deplete the middle class of the capacity for discretionary spending, which was buying all those very nice new automobiles and televisions and computers and everything else, the demand is going to cease, and therefore the, you know, having to provide the supply is going to drive up, and those massive profits are going to disappear. I mean, a guy who makes $2 an hour off in Singapore isn't going to be able to buy a Lexus.
Well, absolutely. And Melody and I have had a couple interviews with Dr. Steve Filling, who is on our campus as a campus leader with the faculty union and with the faculty senate. And what we're seeing in California, Jim, is the deliberate downsizing and privatization, or the attempt to deliberately downsize and privatize public education. The California State University is the largest university in the world. We have 22 campuses and, you know, almost 500,000 students. And what we're seeing is, of course, the cost of tuition going up, classes being canceled, the faculty being dismissed. And the model, of course, they want to follow is a privatized model. And the goal, of course, is to, I think, amongst others, is to reduce the educational level of the American people, making it harder for people to think critically and to challenge or question the version of events that we get from our politicians and from the media.
Well, the University of California, so I was born in Pasadena, California. I grew up in Pasadena, South Pasadena, and you know, the University of California system has been one of the great jewels of higher education in the world. But of course, of late, I mean, since Reagan, you know, became president, and of course now with Arnold in the governor's office and so forth, the situation is dramatically reversed. And with there's so much difficulty with over financing because of the propositions that are passed by the people that don't allow the government of California to raise enough money to provide the services the people want. I mean, the situation is intolerable. I cannot think of a bigger political mess that has been largely created by a form of direct democracy, ironically, because of the public proposition methodology, than what we have in California today.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it just plays right into what we've seen as the Republican agenda given by Grover Norquist, which is, in 20 years, I want to shrink government down to the size where I can drown it in a bathtub. And what he means by that, he wants to drown social services, he wants to drown public education, he wants to drown all spending that would help the little guy, as you say, the average person, and he wants all that money to go back to the rich. And of course that has been the George W. Bush goal, but we're seeing that same Republican agenda being played out here in California now. Even though we have a Democratic president in the White House, we still have a Republican governor in Sacramento, and we have the players in place to try to push this agenda, which definitely is, I think, intended to downsize our middle class and to make it harder for Americans to be upwardly mobile and to think critically.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. And
so there's just lots of fronts where people need to be paying attention. Let me just bring up another question for you, Jim. Maybe you have run across this story. I couldn't put my hands on it just before the interview, but I recall that there is somebody in the Obama administration who's in one of the cabinet positions who wrote a think piece, I think, in 2000, 2008, talking about how you control subversive movements, and they use the example of the 911 Truth Movement, by psychic infiltration.
Yeah.
Have you run across that story?
Yeah, I published an article about it. Let me find the exact title for you. It was an op-ed news. It was called Birds of a Feather, Subverting the Constitution at Harvard Law. And it's by this guy Sunstein, who was on the faculty at Harvard Law. And it's extremely embarrassing. Cass Sunstein and Adrian Vermeule of Harvard Law advocate restrictions on the First Amendment to preclude discussion of conspiracies. They have recommended that JFK assassination researchers and 9/11 truth group should be infiltrated by government agents to subvert them and provoke them into violations of the law for which they might be arrested. They are opposing conspiracy theories by advocating a conspiracy.
Well,
it's actually stunning. It is simply stunning, Eric. And these guys, you know, I mean, I'll give you a recent illustration of how bad it is, you know, dealing with the American press. The Huffington Post invited Jesse Ventura to write an article about 9/11. And once he wrote the article and started suggesting that there was more to it than the official account, they took it down. They did this within 6 hours of its publication and left an apology saying that the journal doesn't discuss conspiracy theories. And I say, well, then they must not be able to discuss 9/11 at all, because after all, these 19 Islamic fundamentalists committing these atrocities under the control of a guy off in a cave in Afghanistan is itself a conspiracy. All they require are two or more individuals collaborating together to bring about an illegal end. So, you know, the Huffington Post, for God's sake? I mean, this is embarrassing. That should be a leading liberal journal, and what it's doing is practicing right-wing politics.
What do you guys think of the book that come out with on Karl Rove? What do you think is going on with that one?
I haven't read it yet, but I'll just tell you, Karl Rove is one of the most dangerous persons ever to have an influential position. You know, this is the Bush's brain guy. I remember sitting in a theater in Duluth, Minnesota, where I was teaching on the campus of the University of Minnesota in that city during the debate with Al Gore, and the camera swung and showed the back of Bush. Actually, they had a pre-arrangement that it would not do that, but the camera did, and it revealed a transmitting device that was clearly discernible beneath his jacket. So Karl Rove had actually been transmitting answers to Bush for questions he otherwise would have been dumbfounded by. I also noticed another astounding development. Well, two more, actually. One was Bush was asked to describe the functions of government. He said that the function of the legislature was to pass the laws, and the function of the executive was to interpret them. He never specified some function for the judiciary, but I mean, he didn't have a junior high school education about the functions of government in the three branches, and Al Gore was so preoccupied with something else that he missed the opportunity to just demolish Bush on the spot. The other problem was Jim Lehrer was hosting one of the debates, and when he came to the crucial question about foreign policy, where he mentioned about 10 different countries, they were alternating who would go first, except in this instance, there was a break in the sequence, and he asked Al Gore first for the second time about this crucial question. So Al Gore, based on his vast understanding of foreign affairs, went through and talked in detail about each of the countries. And then when Lehrer turned to Bush, he just said, same, 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 same. Now, that was the question that would have revealed the stupidity and ignorance of George W. Bush. So they somehow had managed to change the order without Jim Lehrer realizing it. And, of course, Jim Lehrer is a very decent guy, but he had no idea that he'd committed a blunder that gave a massive advantage to George W.
Okay, but I guess what my point was, I see something in the being fomented here with him coming out with this book that looks like they're going to reintroduce him to the public, and they had to kind of clear up his past a little bit.
This was done with W. You know. What was her name, this woman, you know, who's so prominent in the Bush administration, went through all of his files for the Air National Guard in Texas and cleaned them up.
Is that
and
Karen
they,
Hughes?
They do this all the time. It's revisionist history, you know. So Dan Rather actually lost his position and credibility because of a sting operation by the Bush administration. Dan Rather had discovered that there were reports showing that Bush was unfit for duty. He actually had confirmed him with his secretary, who actually typed the report. So she explained that verbatim, yes, what Dan Rather had was exactly what she had typed. He went public with it, and then they pulled the rug out under him by pointing out that the typewriter used to type the report did not exist at the time. They had very cleverly retyped verbatim a report for which they had completely accurate, substantiating confirmation, and yet by substituting a retyped version with a typewriter that had a key that didn't exist earlier, earlier, they were able to discredit him. I mean, the American public reasoned this way. If the document was a fabricated document, then the content of the document must be false, which, of course, is a colossal blunder, but there it is. Now, that is Karl Rove operating at his highest level of efficiency, I guarantee you.
Jim. Yeah, we have to understand that the Bush administration and Rove, this team is extraordinarily Machiavellian in their approach, and the neocons are very Machiavellian, and all this has been traced by Webster Tarpley back to, you know, certain professors at the University of Chicago, again, who have a pedigree
Leo
that
Strauss.
Goes back.
Yeah, Leo Strauss advocates this Nazi philosophy of elitism, where the elites are entitled to lie to the mass of the people and manipulate them any way they want if it's going to benefit them and their interest. I mean, it's completely disgusting. It's as corrupt as it gets.
Yeah, Machiavelli's principles here, and as you say, espoused by Leo Strauss, who's from Germany, a Jew, basically says might makes right, the ends justify the means, you have to divide and conquer the people, you have to lie to the people so that the elite can get what they want. So this is actually what people like Wolfowitz would have learned at the University of Chicago under people like Professor Leo Strauss. So that's what's so interesting. And of course Milton Friedman and the Chicago Boys would have given people the prototype for what they call shock and awe economics, which were implemented in Chile in 1973 with, of course, the CIA coup that overthrew Salvador Allende and brought in Pinochet and the disappearance of 30,000, etc. So it's a 1-2 punch. There's the geopolitical, there's the military, there's the economic, and all of this is very, very, very Machiavellian. And unfortunately, a lot of our very best institutions, our universities, are cranking out these people who are schooled in these techniques. but listen, if I could shift gears a little bit here, Jim, I know we have a little time left, and I'm interested in going back to 911. Now, Dr. Judy Wood has this very, very impressive website, and as you mentioned earlier, she's extraordinarily well qualified, and she's done a tremendous amount of research of the photographic evidence, and she believes that there was a guided hurricane, and now we're talking weather modification, on the morning of September 11th, or the days prior to September 11th, called Hurricane Erin, which she discovered when she looked at satellite photos, which was parked about 90 miles off of the coast of Manhattan. And she thinks that maybe somehow this hurricane, which was perhaps guided by HARP or some other form of directed energy, would have somehow provided energy for the destruction of the towers. Are you familiar with that argument, and do you think you have a sense of how it works?
Well, Judy and I had strained relations when she became involved with this guy, John Hutchison, because I had them on the show, and Hutchison was claiming to have made these discoveries in a very complicated area of physics, really basically electromagnetism, and I know how complicated that area is, so I asked him a few elementary questions about his background. It turns out he really doesn't have a formal education or background. I don't know how far he went in school, but was extremely limited, and Judy became very ticked off with me, so that when I started to hear about this business about the hurricane and all that, I invited her to come back on my show. Now, at that point, I had featured Judy Wood more frequently than any other guest for a very long period of time. I must have had her 15, maybe 20 times as a guest on my show. I extensively discussed her stuff. I took my listeners to her website. We went through it over and over and over again. But Judy basically cut me off because I'd questioned Hutchison, with whom she, I gather, had become romantically involved. And she has not been willing to even respond to repeated invitations I have extended to her to come on the show and talk about it. I do believe that that is the general theory she has in mind, that somehow this hurricane was provided energy for the destruction of the Twin Towers, but I've not been able to induce her to come on the show and actually talk about it, so I cannot say that I know that this is her position. I can only say this is my inference, and I would like it if she were to come on the show with me. I mean, I continue to value her research, but she has declined to do so.
I think we're pretty much in the same boat on that. We're interested in having her back as well, and have not been able to get her. From what I understand, she lost her job at Clemson. She did not get tenure. She did a tremendous amount of research. I don't know exactly where that's standing right now. Her website is still, I think, very, very useful. But this connection between the potential directed energy and the potentially directed hurricane, I think, is very, very fascinating connection and very key if indeed it's true. And of course, what's interesting is that the press at the time made virtually no mention of the fact that there was this Category 3 hurricane.
Yeah.
Just offshore. And so what we see, I think, if we look carefully at the 911 operation, and we have to call it a black operation, is that the press, the media, was in on it, and they were part of the operation. The best research I've seen, and I think you would probably agree, shows that the planes themselves were in fact just images that were inserted into the video, and that there were no real planes that struck the World Trade Center. Certainly, no real planes struck the Pentagon. And so, what we've all perceived as reality was, in fact, a video fake job, an illusion. So 911 then becomes an illusion from top to bottom.
Yeah,
Who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? And I've talked to many scientists.
Right. Very good. Yeah. No, I've written a piece about that. It's entitled New Proof of Video Fakery on 9/11, where I marshal together five or six of the most important arguments that video fakery was taking place and some of the general considerations that support the belief that there may have been, in fact, no commercial carriers involved in the attacks of 9/11, other than one that apparently flew toward the Pentagon and then swooped over it. I actually have a friend from JFK Research who had a buddy who was a trucker in front of the Pentagon who actually witnessed this occurrence, which has been corroborated by the so-called Citizens Investigative Team, who have put together a video called National Security Alert that you can find on the Pilots for 9/11 Truth website, along with their Pandora's Box, which I think is now in a part two, where they actually obtained black box data from the NTSB, which it claimed came from Flight 77. And when the pilots analyzed it, they discovered that the flight data in the recorder was from a completely different trajectory. It was about 300 feet too high. It was heading perpendicular toward the west wing, not at an acute angle, and that it couldn't have hit any of those lampposts. And actually, it was 100 feet above the building when it was 1 second from the purported impact. So all of this fits together to support the conclusion that there was a plane at the Pentagon, but it was used as a deception to deceive and mislead. Here's something wonderful too, Eric, along the lines of what you're pointing out. In my basic lecture on 9/11, I point out that while the lime green civilian fire trucks showed up almost immediately because they just happened to be in the vicinity and extinguished the rather modest fires at the Pentagon within about 15 minutes, later in the day, when the Capitol was purported to have been the target of another hit, and all the congressmen, the representatives, and so forth, and the senators came pouring out on the steps, they looked across the Pentagon and saw enormous billowing black clouds, which were coming, guess what, Eric, not from the building, but from a series of gigantic dumpsters in front of it. I mean, this is absolutely stunning. This is pure Hollywood special effects. I have three different photographs, three images showing the fires and smoke coming from these giant dumpsters. When I was in Duluth in 2006, a fellow came through and knew I had this interest and showed me 44 more frames from a different angle where you could actually see light. You could see daylight between the dumpsters as the source of the emanating black smoke and the building itself, from which no fire was emanating at all. So I'm just telling you how blatant it is that we have had the wool pulled over our eyes, that the government has been lying to the American people from scratch. And of course, as Webster Tarpley has pointed out again and again and again, how could it be that these Arab Arab terrorists would know that on 9/11, we just happened to have as many as 17 different anti-terrorist drills that would basically ground the American Air Force from any form of interdiction of any aircraft that was allegedly hijacked. I believe that, as in the film, the brilliant film War Games, the reason for grounding the Air Force was not to stop them from interfering with the hijackings, but not to go up there and discover there were no hijacked planes, no planes there to have been hijacked. So this whole thing is really quite a farce if you understand it adequately, but it's going to take a long time, though there are signs of progress in informing the American people.
Well, on that note, two questions. One question I get repeatedly is, what happened to the passengers on those planes? And what I tell them is, well, we don't know. But it would seem that one of the planes was the passengers were disembarked into FEMA facility at an airport, and the others may have actually been crashed over the Atlantic Ocean. But we know that those planes with the numbers on the tail pieces of those planes were actually changed several years later, right?
Well, I have the FAA registration data that shows two of the aircraft reportedly involved in 9/11 were not deregistered until the following year, and two others were not deregistered until like 5 years later. So the whole situation is completely absurd. According to the FAA's own data, these planes were still flying around not long after 9/11. Now, about the passengers, there's some very serious peculiarities here. David Ray Griffin recently published an article in Global Research in which he explained that all of the phone calls purported to have been made from these aircraft are fake. All of them are fake. Even the FBI confirmed that the purported phone call that was the most celebrated between Ted Olson, our former Solicitor General, and his wife, who was a prominent right-wing commentator, never went through, that there was no such phone call, even though Ted Olson gave three different versions of his conversations with his wife. It was all fabricated. It was all fake. Now, Colonel George Nelson, who's a U.S. Air Force crash expert, has observed that each of these planes had hundreds of thousands of uniquely identifiable component parts, and yet from all four of these crash sites, which would entail over a million of these uniquely identifiable component parts, the government has yet to produce a single one. So, when you have these reporters showing up, for example, in Pennsylvania, and they're independent reporters, and they're saying the strangest thing about this crash site is there's no evidence that any plane crashed there, when you have Jamie McIntyre showing up at the Pentagon saying, you know, it's really strange, but he sees no signs that any plane actually hit the Pentagon, when you realize that video fakery was taking place at New York, you have to ask yourself, were these planes simply phantoms? And if the planes were phantoms, then that leads you to the further inference that possibly the passengers were fake too. It would be simpler to fake passengers than it would be to dispose of all those bodies. Now, there is this possibility you allude to, which is there is a report that a plane landed at Cleveland Airport, that it offloaded some 200 passengers at a remote terminal. It was all done under great security. The mayor of the city came out. He was actually interviewed by a television crew. He identified the flight as 93, and to get 200 passengers, you'd have to put together all the passengers on each of those four flights, because they were only about 25% full, which, of course, on its face is an absurdity from a business point of view, because you can't make money flying transcontinental flights that are only 25% full. So there is the possibility that if this story is authentic, that maybe they were all loaded into one plane and flown to Cleveland, a fairly obscure location, by the way, maybe easier to conceal. But there's this profound difference in the attitude of the families of those who purportedly were passengers and of the families of those who died in New York City when the buildings disappeared. You know, I mean, 1,100 bodies were never, nothing was ever found, not a fingernail, a toe, an eyelash, as it were. The families of those who died in New York on 9/11 all are intensely interested in what happened and want to get to the bottom of it, want to learn the truth. The families of those who purportedly had relatives on the planes have no interest in getting to the truth, don't want to talk about it. It's as though they got a bonanza from the government, which gave them a huge sum of money as compensation for the loss of the lives of their families. They realize the government made a mistake, but they'll be damned if they want to give up the money. They're just not going to talk about it. So I think those are the two possibilities. I don't know of any third alternative.
Now, Ellen Mariani was somebody who lost a relative or her husband on one of those planes, supposedly. Isn't that the case? And didn't she have a lawsuit against the government?
Yes, she did. Yes, she did. Phil Berg, who was a former deputy attorney general for the state of Pennsylvania, was representing her. I tried to get Ellen on the show to talk about her case, and I cannot explain why, but she never responded to me. I think that is interesting. I do think some people died on 9/11 that the government may have wanted, had an interest in getting rid of. I gather there are, for example, quite a few high executives of Raytheon purportedly aboard Flight 77. And it may just be that the government really had an interest in getting rid of these guys because they knew too much about 9/11 and they wanted to, you know, get rid of witnesses who could be inconvenient. But, you know, that's a different matter than whether these planes full of passengers somehow were flown out over the ocean or crashed or what have you. I'd say this is one of the most mysterious aspects of the entire case. I mean, we know a lot about 9/11, but we don't know everything. What we do know about it, however, will make your hair curl.
Okay, let me ask you this. I know we've only got a limited time, maybe 10 minutes. Jim, where do you think the 911 truth movement is? Could you give us a brief rundown of what are the groups that are active? How many people are active in the groups? I know there's 911 movements in various cities and various states.
Well,
And let me know if there's another conference coming down the pike and if you're planning to put one together.
Well, here's the deal. With the split in scholars, it led to a proliferation, actually, the emergence of multiple independent groups. For example, there was this segment of scholars that created a new entity called 9/11 Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. But that's not the significant development. The significant development is the emergence of these independent groups like Pilots for 9/11 Truth or Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and so forth, because these are more specialized entities that have focused on different aspects of the case, and in my opinion, they are making major inroads. And even if I disagree with the specific account that Richard Gage is advocating to explain the destruction of the Twin Towers, I think that he's making all these presentations, and I think it may be close to 1,000 at this point in time all around the country, can only continue to stimulate interest in what's going on. Now, the single best place to go is PatriotsQuestion911.com. If you go to PatriotsQuestion911.com, you'll find what must be, at this point in time, nearly 2,000 professionals and experts across the military, the government, intelligence agencies, the various sciences, engineers, architecture, pilots, aeronautical engineers, civil engineers, academicians across multiple fields. You'll find their bio sketches, you'll find their photographs, and you'll find their statements about 9/11. Now, what this means is that the 9/11 movement is deep and the 9/11 movement is wide. I believe that the other nations of the world have a very clear fix on exactly what happened on 9/11, and it's only because of the massive control exerted over the media in America by as few as 5 corporations, all of whom have close ties to the government, who, after all, regulates them with regard to their business of controlling the airwaves, that if it were not for that, most Americans would understand, as well as Europeans and Russians and even those in the Middle East, that this really was an inside job, that it was collusion between key elements in the American government who were called themselves neocons, but really were, that was a misdescription, because they really were Zionists in collusion with elements of the Mossad. I believe the destruction World Trade Center was outsourced to the Mossad. It's very tough for Americans to plan deliberately to murder 3,000 fellow Americans. But if you study the history of Zionism and the operation of the Mossad, you'll find that that is exactly what they do time and time and time again. Again, I reiterate this interesting book, Stranger Than Fiction, that you can find very easily, 150 pages. You'll understand the whole history of this movement and how time after time after time these representatives of the government of Israel have perpetrated dastardly acts, faked themselves to be Arabs and blown up the King George Hotel, attacked the USS Liberty, for example, intending to blame it on Egyptians, in a series of other atrocities that really, I think, provides a convincing evidence that there's really only one imprint here on a whole mass of affairs, false flag attacks from Argentina to today, and that is the operation of the Mossad. So I say, if you really want to come to grips with the real history of the world, you're going to have to embrace the fact that conspiracies are ubiquitous, that they make the biggest difference in the course of events. FDR used to say, if something happens in politics, you can bet it wasn't merely by accident, that it was done on purpose, that the planning for World War II, for World War III, and other forms of treachery have been very powerfully affected by those who felt that it, in their heart and mind, that there was an absolute need to have a nation of Israel as a separate, independent, and very powerful country. And I just tell you, it's very scary, the state of play today, Eric, because I have encountered rumors that the Israeli government is willing to take the rest of the world with it if it's the existence of Israel were threatened. And it is my belief that, you know, Israel having no good reason to have manufactured 200 to 600 nuclear weapons, I fear it's all too probable that they have those weapons in their embassies all over the world and that they could perform a feat of nuclear blackmail on the other nations of the world if and when they decide the time has come. I think the situation is that bad.
Well, let me ask you this, because this is a speculation that I've had privately. You mentioned the possibility of nuclear blackmail, Israel having somewhere between 200 and 600 nuclear weapons. Do you suppose that this has already happened, that maybe nuclear blackmail was used in the 911 operation and perhaps others?
Well, my greatest fear is that they've already transported these nuclear weapons to their embassies all over the world because, you know, diplomatic pouches and officially are not subject to investigation or inspection by the countries that host those nations. My study here of Israel leads me to conclude that they are sufficiently self-centered and malevolent that this actually could be something that they have done already. Whether or not 9/11 involved Israeli blackmail, that's a very interesting question. It wouldn't surprise me, however, if there were some truth to that, though I don't have any direct evidence that that's the case.
Yeah. Well, let me just read here a little bit from Alan Sabrowski, who is this U.S. Army War College writer. He says in his piece, only two intelligence agencies had the expertise, assets, access, and political protection to execute 9/11 in the air and on the ground, our CIA and Israel's Mossad. And I should mention that our CIA helped found Israel's Mossad. Only one had the incentive, using the who benefits principle, Mossad. And that incentive dovetailed perfectly with the neocons' agenda and explicitly expressed need for a cataclysmic event to mobilize the American public for their wars, using American military power to destroy Israel's enemies. Only the unexpected strength of the Iraqi resistance kept Syria and Iran from being attacked in the second Bush administration. Thus, the evidential trail for 9/11 and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq runs from PNAC, AIPAC, which, of course, is a very powerful lobby in Washington for Israel, and their cohorts, through the mostly Jewish neocons in the Bush administration and back to the Israeli government. None of the denials and political machinations can alter that essential reality. Terms such as treason, betrayal, and deceit do not overstate the case against them. So,
well,
anyway, he has come to the same conclusion.
Yeah, this guy's quite brilliant. Actually, I had him lined up to be a guest on my show, but he slipped and fell and injured his head and suffered from some serious headaches, which I would like to believe is purely coincidental. But the fact of the matter is he's done performed heroic act on behalf of the nation by publishing several articles that make these points, and I think it's becoming extraordinarily difficult from anyone who's informed and aware of persons of his stature making these points that they not that they can no longer take them, you know, casually dismiss them or suggest that that's merely conspiratorial thinking or some form of anti-Semitism. It's actually biting the bullet and coming up with confronting the grim truth. The reality about the dirty politics that runs this country and the extent to which our nation, especially its foreign policy, is dominated by the interests of a foreign power and not those of the citizens of the United States.
Yeah, he also says here towards the end of his article, and this is referring again to AIPAC, this is a very, very powerful Israeli lobby. AIPAC and company are riding a tiger in America. And if they ever slip, the resulting convulsion will be catastrophic for them and for Israel. The open unfolding of the 9/11 tragedy and its ensuing wars that is now occurring can be that slip. The human cost to America to date is some 60,000 people, military and civilian, killed or wounded on 9/11 and in Iraq and Afghanistan together, with more to come once we go to war with Iran or get dragged into it following an Israeli attack on Iran. Much of the deliberately misdirected rage that followed 9/11 has given way to endurance and grief, captured all too well. He says that an enraged America could turn the tables on Israel if they discovered the real culprits of this operation.
And that's where you and I and Melody come in, Eric, informing the American people of the truth, the reality behind the scene, the fiction of 9/11.
Okay, can we go ahead and bring this down to, it's getting to the end of the evening here, and if we can get your guys' closing comments to kind of finish it out?
Well, I would just like to thank Dr. James Fetzer again. The books and the websites that you recommended, I'm looking forward to checking out on, and I'm very, very gratified to see that our thinking has converged. We've both been working on this, I think you more visibly, and you've got more out on it, but I've been reading away as well, and so it's just been a real pleasure to talk to you again, Jim, and really appreciate your work and look forward to continuing the conversation hopefully in the future.
My great pleasure, Alan, and in addition to my blog at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, check out Eric's site at 911nwo.com and 911, rediscover911.com if you want to pursue leads about these crucial issues, if you want to understand what's going on to your country and possibly put yourself in a position to do something about it. Melanie, I can't thank you enough. Eric, I can't thank you enough. This is an important program, and I'm grateful to have had the chance to participate.
Well, and we're grateful that you accepted, and then I want to thank both of you gentlemen this evening. And that we hope we do this again.
Okay, thanks very much.
Great pleasure.
Okay, good night.